And now, the continuing adventures of Superhero Speak, episode 27. Hey everyone, I just want to acknowledge that, yes, the episodes have been a little spotty lately in their release. I've had some personal issues in my life, and that's caused me not to be able to work on the show for the last few weeks. Hopefully those issues are behind me now, and the show will go back on as scheduled. I thank those who have been listening to the podcast still for continuing to listen to it, and hopefully we won't be interrupted again. I also want to give a big shout out to the rest of my hosts. That is Ben, John, Pete, and Scott. Those guys carried on with Agents of Speak while I was out. They did a great job, and we want to officially welcome Pete to the fold. You can reach Pete at pete@superheroespeak.com, but he'll be on more episodes coming up. This episode is John and I sitting down with Coat of Arms founder and CEO Joe Carbo. So sit back, enjoy, and here we go. Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and this is your host Dave.
And John.
And today we have a guest with us. He is the founder and, I guess, CEO of Coat of Arms, and he's currently working with Hound Comics, and we're anxious to get to know him. So everyone, welcome Joe Carbone to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So Joe, as I just said, you have your own imprint, I guess, or imprint or company. What's the term that you use?
At this point, I look at myself with the rest of my team as a studio.
A studio, okay. Yeah. And so, tell us a little bit about Coat of Arms. Like, how and why did you found it?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm like any other kid that walked into a comic book store and read the comics and talked with all the guys and was like, oh, I could do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And after years of having those conversations in the comic book stores, I finally decided, you know, maybe I should try it. And I had a couple of stories that I always wanted to put down into a format, you know, a visual format. And it just started to happen one day. And I just started typing out my first script. And from there, things built onto what they are today.
Cool. Because I was reading your bio a little bit online.
Sure.
And was it The Hulk was the first comic that you fell in love with?
Yeah, actually, I was a little kid that was a Hulk fan. Mm-hmm. Lou Ferrigno was on the TV show, and I was enamored with the giant green body and the parallel power that he had, you know, that ridiculousness of just being able to do anything he wanted, but being cursed by the fact that he had to do it in a blind rage.
Yeah. And,
that just kind of drew me in. And then a couple years later, when I was a little bit older and, you know, I ended up with my dad in a comic book store, and there was a comic book with Thor fighting the Hulk on the cover, and that was it. I was sold.
Yeah. I think a lot of people in our age group, fell in love with comics for the Hulk because you know, he was on TV all the time, and was a very interesting character, colorful character, you know. So I can see why people were sucked in by him. You know,
I was also I also think that the Banner of our era was way different than modern Banner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think that changed a lot over time. You know, like to me, he felt more like an everyman. But now in today's comics, you read he's creating super weapons and doing all kinds of next level Tony Stark stuff. And you always knew that Banner was brilliant. You always knew that he was a smart doctor, but you never, you know, at least I never did. I never put him in like, oh, okay, he could help Mr. Fantastic kind of mode, you know?
Yeah, you kind of get the feeling from the original TV series that, yeah, he tried an experiment. It failed miserably to the point where it made him the Hulk. And now he's trying to figure out a way to fix it. Whereas the comic book character you get today is, well, if he's so damn smart, how come he hasn't fixed it yet?
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's almost unrealistic to the origin, but it makes a lot of sense too, because you'd have to think that, you know, you would need somebody with Tony Stark level intelligence to build a bomb that would mutate a human being into a giant monster. So there's, you know, it's comic books. It all kind of weighs out in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually one of the things I think in the more modern comic books that bothers me a little bit is they're trying to make everyone super intelligent, you know, especially in the Marvel universe. Like, you know, Spider-Man, they've done more things to try to show that he's intelligent, you know, pre-Doc Ock.
Yeah, I was going to say, except for changing his personality.
Tony Stark is a super genius. Bruce Banner is a super genius. And it's like, you know, like John just said, yeah, it doesn't make sense that he doesn't get cured. Like, there can be different levels of intelligence, you know?
I get that point, and it makes sense. But I think also, too, is as a creator looking at it and as a writer's point of view, in the modern world, it would be harder for me to not have a character with that kind of intelligence do things that are so over the top. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, when, you know, we're talking about Bruce Banner being created, you know, there was no cell phones, there was no internet, there was no Google, there was no supercomputers, there was, right. You know. So now that those things exist in our world, you have to up the ante in the fictional world as well. So it plays off exactly the way that it should, but, you know, for some of us that I hate to say as old-timers, but, you know, right. Us kids with the staples in the 80s, you know, it's a very different world, especially after, you know, the Ultimates line and the Marvel Knights line and the Infinite, you know, crises and all the other things that have changed things so many times, you know?
Yeah. So then I guess you bought that Thor Hulk issue. And you said they were fighting on the cover. So who won?
Actually, it's one of the very first times that Hulk lifts up the hammer. And what happens in the story is, I don't want to get too far into it because I don't know if Marvel will sue me or not, but end up in a tunnel and Thor has to choose between fighting the Hulk or saving the people in the tunnel. So Thor does the heroic thing and holds the tunnel up, and in his rage, the Hulk tries to lift up the actual hammer, and he finally picks it up in a total insane rage and turns Thor back into Blake.
Okay.
And, you know, then he has to crawl across the tunnel and see, you know, it's very, very action oriented and very awesome.
So speaking as an old timer, it wasn't the episode with Thor in the old original Hulk series that got you interested in that?
You could rag on it, but I have to admit, of all the Marvel characters that showed up on that show, Thor definitely had the best appearance.
Yeah.
He's better than Daredevil.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Anything was better than Daredevil. God, even the movie couldn't get it right.
And you don't have to worry about Marvel suing. You know, we're waiting for that day.
Awesome. Let me know, okay?
You know, no press is bad press. So.
True enough.
So I guess you started collecting after that. Was it all Marvel or?
No, I had kind of like a mixed collection where I felt like I read more of the outside Marvel stuff, like Hulk, and, you know, I was reading the X-Men before the Jim Lee era, so that was kind of more of an outside title, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But then for DC, I was very mainstream, like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Justice League, like those were the ones that I was reading in DC. And I never, like, branched out to Constantine or any of those kind of characters, Swamp Thing, things like that, which I appreciate now looking back at him and reading him today, but back then, it just wasn't what my draw was.
That's interesting. And I'm the same way, I think, when it comes to DC. It's a lot easier to take in the main characters because we're fed with them in so much different media that it's just easy to reading a Batman story, and you could pick up any Batman story in the run, but, you know, at any point, pick it up and read it, and it's like an old friend. But trying to figure out Swamp Thing, who you don't know anything about, you feel lost going in.
Or Sandman or Constantine. Those had really strange storylines.
Well, I think DC's thing back then was the dynamic of they played heroic perfectly. You know what I'm saying? Like Superman was the perfect hero and Batman were the perfect heroes. And then when they had the darker characters that had the personalities that more people would gravitate to in the real world, it was harder to pick through that because you were so used to seeing this spotless, awesome universe where, you know, Superman could punch the Earth in half kind of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Like, right.
And that, I think that kind of dynamic is what always was a problem for me. But I think that the modern DC in the 50, you know, in the 52 reboot, they cleared that up a little bit. I think that there's a little bit more of a, I don't want to say a depowering, but kind of more of a level playing field where everybody is seeing all the villains and all the heroes, you know, more in a generic frame of, yeah, you know, this guy might be able to take down a building, but, you know, he's got his flaws too. And you could see the struggles more. And I think that's been a big plus for DC recently.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think they've done a lot of good things in the New 52. A lot of people are having a hard time swallowing a reboot of the entire universe. And, you know, it's funny, people are complaining about it, but they're reading it. So I think DC wins either way. So you've read a lot of Marvel, read a lot of DC, and I'm assuming that these played a lot into your influences of when you started writing. So what was the first thing you started writing?
The first thing I started writing was a story called Conquistador.
Okay.
I'm one of those people that likes to stay up late at night and end up flipping through like Discovery Channel and things like that, and I'll end up absorbing, you know, that kind of historical stuff, and it'll spark something else, or some kind of true event will initiate what I call moments of brilliance. And I had come across a show that was really basically talking about how the significance of the Spanish coming to, you know, the world, the new world, really just changed everything in every perspective, you know, from the way we looked at navigation to, you know, religion, and of course the mass genocides and every aspect of it. And that really struck with me as being a really interesting time period of life. You know, it's like these people were discovering what we discover in space just across an ocean. Like, it was a whole new universe, and there was so much corruption in that. What happened was I started to wonder what would happen if the corruption of the old world met a corruption in the new world. And Conquistador basically came to pieces that way. Mainly it's the story of my main character, Victor De La Cruz, who is a small officer on the second expedition to the United States by Ponce de Leon. And historically what happens is, Ponce de Leon comes to the United States twice. You know, he comes to Florida once, discovers it, goes back to tell all the, you know, the local governors, and then they give him money to go back to Florida again. And this time he brings settlers, and the settlers all get wiped out in our world by natives. And I changed that premise, and I changed what happens and how it happens, and basically kind of rewrote the Ponce de Leon mythos with this character. And that's kind of what happened there.
Cool. Sounds actually kind of interesting. I'm a little bit of a history buff, so that kind of stuff always interests me.
Where'd you do your research for this? I mean, did you like spend months looking at Google and Wikipedia to find out about how the settlers lived and all that to write the, because writing historical stuff is historically it's very hard to get it right, you know?
Well, what was cool about the situation that I had was a lot of what I needed was really just numbers, you know, like I needed to know how many settlers there were, because they don't play a very intriguing part in a story. Like, they come in very quickly, and then the events that lead Victor into becoming what he becomes, which, you know, I'll explain later, will, you know, the main characters, I really had to be more historically accurate with Ponce himself. Like, I couldn't just say, well, Ponce dies in Florida, because that's not what happens. You know, he survives the attack, and he ends up, I believe it's Puerto Rico off the top of my head. I haven't thought about it in a while, but he ends up dying there after an infection from a blowgun dart. So I had to keep those kind of facts true. But I didn't really need to worry about the names of the sailors or any of that other stuff, because they didn't play enough of a role in my story for me to have to do that. You know, Victor ends up being the sole survivor of the attack pretty quick. And the only thing I really had to worry about was how many men there were, how many women there were, you know, what their purposes were, how many people made it back, who many people didn't. And that's what I stuck with. And a lot of my research came via, you know, having to read about other explorers and, you know, getting the secondary notes because, you know, Ponce kind of had time to tell a story, but there wasn't that much time. He got sick very quickly and died pretty quickly because of his injuries, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it left me a lot of open field to play with. So that was kind of another draw to the aspect of the story that I used to get, you know, my story moving.
Right. No, that's actually, that sounds like a very good way to go. You know, find a piece of history that is open-ended in some ways, where there isn't a lot of information about it, and rewrite, not necessarily rewrite history, but, you know, tell a story that could have happened in that time period.
I mean, the one thing that, you know, the native tribe that really did the attack that, you know, historically was known, and, you know, they were a real Native mm-hmm. American tribe, I in no way in my stories try to portray the villains of my story as those people. You know,
right.
my tribe is a totally different monster, and I mean that in a literal sense. Like, they, you know, it's got nothing to do with the actual Native Americans of that time period and that kind of stuff. And I would never in any way, you know, in front of anybody say that it is. You know, if somebody came up to me and they were an elder of that tribe, you know, I would not apologize for insulting their people, but I would definitely tell them that I did not base my people off of you, you know?
Right. Right. And then, the other title that you have, is the Chronicles of Mare.
It's Mary. Nobody gets it right.
Okay.
That's what happens when you write a name when you're like 14. So, the Chronicles of Mary is the first title we went to print with. Basically I've always been a hardcore gamer. I've always been, you know,
mm-hmm.
embroiled in fantasy. I've always loved that kind of storyline. And Mary was a very loose interpretation of my role-playing days and the characters that I created then.
Right.
And like, Wolfgang was the first character I created in Dungeons & Dragons when I was like, I don't know, 8 or 9.
Right. You know?
We all have those.
Yeah. And, you know, even with my buddies today, we'll still play every once in a while, and I'll still play as Wolfgang, you know, almost 30 years later.
Right.
But the Wolfgang in my story is very different. My universe is solely unique, and it's really kind of my way of dealing with a lot of questions, you know, like like the creation of the universe and things like that. Like, I've put a lot of my own mythology and my own questions on mythology and on, you know, religion and things like that into this story and created what is something I'm very proud of, you know?
That's actually very fascinating to go from the two stories in the sense of Conquistador is based on actual events from history, and then to go to a fantasy world where you're creating everything and you don't have to follow any real rules, you know, of this world, because you can create whatever you want. Was that hard to do, or was it easier to do?
Well, when I was writing it, I would say it was harder to do. When I was creating it, it was definitely easier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way that my storyline has been written was, I started out with a mythology tale, and I had gone all the way through the whole process of writing this. And by the time I was done, I knew I had not written a first issue. And I had gone on to my second issue, and my second issue became my first issue, and my first issue became my zero issue.
And okay.
To this day, that's how they're in print. And
mm-hmm.
I just think that ended up being a much better way to tell a story for the kind of the epic scope that I'm trying to portray as time goes on with the story itself.
Right. So And being a fantasy, it's got to be. It's interesting because, like you said, everyone, a lot of not everyone, but a lot of people have played Dungeons and Dragons, and I find the games that go well, everyone is into it. Everyone's adding a piece to the story as it unfolds. All the characters have something to play in, into what's going on, and you have a set of rules in Dungeons and Dragons. You're not creating a lot of things from scratch. You know, the Dungeon Master has a set of monsters to use, a set of you know, rules that he has to follow. But you know, when you go to write something, you're creating it totally from scratch. You know, to me, fantasy seems like it's the hardest thing to write because, you know, fantasy fans also are horrible for pointing out, you know, in book one, this was true. Now in book four, you know, he was able to get around that. Like, he couldn't defeat this guy because of this rule that you set up in book two. But in book four, he got around that rule somehow, and you didn't explain it, you know. And that, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like that would be a fear of a fantasy writer. Have you run into that at all?
No, not yet. My biggest thing with fantasy writing when I started it was I didn't want to create Tolkien. I didn't want to create, you know, Gygax. You know, I didn't want to go back to the familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, my universe is very specifically designed to be similar to what people know, but to be so unique that it draws you in. Like, just as an example, like the dwarves in my story, they do exist, but in my tale, they've been cursed and they've been enslaved by dragonkind. And what happened was there was a massive war in the early history of my world. And mm-hmm. It was a war basically started by prejudice, and all the races of the world basically tried to annihilate each other. And the gods beg the dragon kind to put an end to it, and they do. But what happens is the dwarves, because of their nature, would not relent. No matter how much they kept coming, you know, the dwarves would send their babies to their deaths. So what happened was the dragons combined their magical might, and they encased all of dwarven kind into a form of living stone, which, if shattered, eliminates that dwarf forever. And now the dwarves were unable to procreate. They were unable to do anything that they would normally do as a species. And they basically became this humbled, broken, sad race, you know, where for thousands of years, you know, even infants have become elders, you know. And those are the kind of twists that I added to my story. Like, another big deal is I think my story is officially the only story where I can say that elvenkind is the enemy.
Hmm. Okay.
That's one of the core elements of the story.
Right. I mean, right.
You have dark elves and stuff like that, but in my story, the elves are in it for themselves, and they've sided with the enemy, and they look at all other races as just this small little speck of dust that they can kick around and do whatever they want with. And a lot of the development in the story comes from my one character, Mitch, who is an elven prince who's an outcast by his own people because he doesn't see life in that manner. He thinks that all life is important.
Right.
And that allows him to change his skew, which will, of course, lead to other things in the future of the story.
All right. I mean, it's interesting. Everything that you're saying, it definitely sounds like it's worth picking up. I'm gonna are you gonna be at New York Comic Con?
I'll be walking the show.
Okay.
You know, I didn't get a booth last year. I actually premiered at the New York Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great response. You know, I sold a couple of hundred issues on my own. I had a small little crew that was with me, and you know, we all did everything we could and we pitched it out. I gave away about 100 copies of the Zero issue, and you know, I got a lot of great response. But, you know, the issue is being a, you know, speck of sand in the ocean.
Right, right. Oh, yeah.
When it comes to media coverage and things like that, that's kind of where I hit the bumpy roads that I did.
Yeah, that's unfortunately, especially New York Comic Con and all the bigger ones, it's harder for the little guys anymore because they've become such media events that, you know, the people that are walking around Artist Alley are going, you know, to the main people that they know. Very few people I've noticed, and maybe I'm wrong, but not as many people go to the independents anymore. And
I agree with you, but I don't honestly blame the scope of the actual cons for that problem. I blame the arrangement of the cons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a huge part of it. Yeah.
The simplest answer to fix that is just put the Artist Alley and the independent press intermingled. Mm-hmm. And that's better sales for everyone. That gets more artists to walk through, gets more people to walk through on the independent. And you got to keep in mind, a lot of the artists that are on the Artist Alley and a lot of these shows are independent, small printing artists.
Right.
If they were close to booths that they were making money in, then, you know, you're introducing them to new people to get jobs and you're introducing them to the broader scope. And that's the one issue. Like, there should never be a time in any convention where somebody has to go to an independent small press area and go away from the artists and the anchors and that, you know, like mm-hmm. you can have all your, you know, your t-shirt sales and all your comic book booths and all your video game booths and all that stuff is all great and dandy. You know, that's why we're there.
Right.
But comics and art should be intermingled. There should never be that break. And that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I remember one year in Philly at Wizard, they had put all the celebrities up front when you walked in, especially the big name celebrities. And all the artists and vendors were like, whoa, no one's coming back here because they're all stopping where the celebrities are, you know? But yeah, no, I mean, intermixing them makes a lot of sense. You're right. They should never be separated, you know?
It's funny that's such a problem because it's usually the independents that have the better ideas because they haven't been institutionalized yet. They usually have the more original storylines, the more quirky characters, the more story-driven plots instead of just, you know, one superpower against another. They're better comics overall.
Well, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the freedom of being on the outside. You know, the minute you get into the loop, you know, which is something we all want to do. I mean, if I could write The Punisher tomorrow, I would quit work and I'd have, you know, issues out within days, you know, like not a problem. But once I walk into that world, I have to write in the Punisher zone. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I have to adhere to those rules. Just exactly what you were saying about, you know, in the creation of my own fantasy world, I kind of am able to do whatever I want. But I knew immediately that if I gave myself too much leeway, people would tear it apart. So my world has very set mythology. And that's what I wanted to make sure people saw when I started putting the story together. Like, the dragons are the enemy. They control the world, period. They have an air force. Nobody else does. Humans are total dirt. And that's because, you know, a family of humans could have 15, 20 kids. So dragons look at us like rabbits. They eat us. That's it. We have no education in our story. We have no foundations for government. We're slaves to everybody else. And, you know, if you're happy enough and able to live outside of their direct control, you have a better than decent chance of making it to your 50s. Anytime else, you're probably going to be worked to death. You know, like, and that's how I built the story. I wanted people to see that, yeah, I'm different. Yeah, I'm new, but, you know, I understand that there's got to be some kind of control. Otherwise, you just have madness. And then you're creating a cartoon, not a comic book.
Right, right. But that's also, I think, you know, I think one of one of the struggles of an independent, you know, is, you know, Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, they're the comfortable shoes, you know. They've been around so long, everyone knows them, and you don't, you know, like I said, it's so easy to pick up a Batman story anywhere in the run and understand what's going on. But with an independent, when you have a whole new world that you don't know, it's tough sometimes to sell people on that, you know. And I give kudos to you for doing it. That's my favorite thing about going to a con is walking through Artist Alley and talking to all the guys with the independent comics, you know, because you're doing what you love, you know, you have a passion for it, and it's not easy, but you know, the reward is worth it in the end when somebody picks up the book and they read it and they're like, oh wow, this is really good.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But you know, there's the good and the bad with both angles. I mean, when you're working on your own, you know, it's harder to get what you need done. You know, you got to rely on people outside the loop. You know, luckily I have an artist I trust, you know, he gives me great work. I have, you know, cover artists that I pay that do amazing work that, you know, they get what I'm trying to create because I've been very specific in the vision and they jumped on it and ran with it. So it's harder to come into, I almost want to say it's harder to give birth to a new comic on the independent than it is in the bigger scheme, because at least when you're in the bigger system, there's other guys in the room, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. Well, I need to come up with a cooler font. Okay, Tommy, you go do that. You know, I need to come up with three villains. What do you got? You know, like, those meetings, I'm sure, are a blessing. I wish that I had some, but, you know, I got to do what I got to do.
Right, right. So, actually, that brings me to something we really haven't officially talked about yet on the interview. So you're now partners with Helen Comics? Like, how is that?
We are joint with Hound. It's the only way to describe it.
Okay.
We don't have like a formal partnership of stocks or anything like that. But basically, we are reprinting under Hound's label. We are putting out the zero issue, and the first issue should have been out already, but it's probably going to be out more towards the end of the month.
Okay.
But, you know, and that's just minor things, adjusting fonts and trying to get logos to match up with pre-existing stuff.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, minor things that foresight would have prevented, but, you know, things happen. That's what I'm saying. The team is, you know, having a bigger team that makes things easier. But we're growing, you know. Moving in with Hound has been a huge benefit because there's a lot of recognition when dealing with Hound and, you know, Brimstone is a pretty down-to-earth guy, and, you know, he's the kind of person that if you talk to him for a while, you understand where he's coming from, because he puts everything out there in a way that it's just so genuine, it's hard to think that he would not be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And just all the things and all the concepts, like the goals that I have as a writer and as a creator for comics, you know, the Hound team shares, and that's why it was just the perfect matching at the perfect time.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. You know, obviously, you know, we interviewed Brim on here, and we talked to him for a while. And actually, there's about 40 minutes that wasn't posted and won't ever be posted, but that's another story. But it's funny because he was great to talk to, because there's a lot about him, believe it or not, that reminds me of Stan Lee. You know, not only because, you know, Stan Lee is the ultimate self-marketer, and I think Brim is really good at it too.
Yeah, Brim is really good at self-marketing.
But you also, when you talk to him, you right away you just get the feeling that he's being open and honest with you. You know, he's not holding stuff back. He's telling it how it is. You know, what he can share, and right, he's a straight shooter, and I've always gotten that feeling from Stan Lee, all the interviews I've ever heard with him, when I got to meet him last year and got a chance to talk to him, you know, just like, you know, so he seems like he'd be a great guy, Brim, a great guy to be a partner with on anything.
Yeah, I was... You know, when I first came into the company, I was welcomed in, and we went to the actual Chicago Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Brim, we had about, you know, 30 hours back and forth where we just talked about the future and what we wanted. And, you know, talking to him, I was able to get, you know, a lot of personal stuff out and just kind of connect with him, where it was just kind of like an old friendship kind of deal, where it was like I felt like I knew everywhere he had been and he knew where I was, and we were kind of just gelling in that moment. You know, it was like, you know, he understood my plights in my life and my home life, and he you know, he gave me good advice, and, you know, we talked about what we want as a company and how we would both want to create and what our grand visions for the comics that we create are. I think one of the little differences me and Will have is I'm a little more willing to push the envelope when it comes to, you know, violence and, you know, things like that. But it's not the kind of thing where, you know, oh, Joe's putting together a story, we're going to get the Vertigo label out. You know, like, that's not my setup at all, you know?
Right, right.
But, and I just think that's because of the kind of person he is. He's got that more of a lighthearted, you know, way about him where, you know, I couldn't see him ever having written a story that was very intensely dark without it having some moment of humor in it. Like Lush is a great example in the Borderlands title, you know, like, I would always kind of feel like a creation of his would have that element at some scope or another.
Yes, and it's surprising coming from someone who is a professional wrestler, but, you know, that...
You can never judge anybody right. cover, man. You know, I've met so many people on so many different levels. You know, I started my media life as a cameraman for the local news, and, you know, I saw celebrities that did things to people that, you know, if I had a bat, I would have just ratted him in the head with, you know, like that kind of level. And then I saw the most generous and innocent children doing things that, you know, you couldn't imagine a child even processing. And, you know, just a matter of the kind of person that you want to be is really what, you know, dictates a true person's personality. And, you know, that's kind of what you get, you know. And, right. You know, I think a lot of the strength that Hound has right now is from the people that I've dealt with and the people that I've met. You know, I'm still new to the company, but, you know, I have nothing but respect for everybody I'm working with. And that's because everybody seems to have such genuine goals, and everybody really, you know, is in the same mode. Everybody wants to put out the best stories they can. Everybody wants to, you know, succeed in this and move forward in ways that really champion that success, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a core element, you know, especially with a creative team. If you guys aren't on the same page or you guys don't have the same goal, it's always going to be a pain. And that's just the way that, you know, the world is.
Right. So, along the lines of, you know, the one difference that you and Brim have, you know, with the violence, leads me to a question. And if you're not comfortable answering it, you don't have to. So one of the things with independent comics, and one of the reasons a lot of people do it is, it's creator owned. It's they control the book totally themselves. No one's influencing it. They can do what they want, and they own it. So, you know, if there's any rights around it, they maintain it all. Since it's a partnership with Hound, do you still retain all the control of your titles, or how's that work?
I haven't had anybody ever tell me what to do when it came to how we were setting up the stories, but the creative aspect that we have hasn't been in that level yet. I mean, my story starts out with, you know, a definitive rape, you know, like there's, you know, that happens. That's really, you know, I don't try to hide that, but I don't show that. And there's ways as a creator where you could be clever and not do something distasteful, or in a way that's so distasteful it would turn people against you. And, you know, like when we were at the conventions with parents, you know, I would tell them, this is not something that, you know, if you want to read this and you want your son to have it, you read it first and you make that determination, because, you know, there's adult content in it.
Right.
And, you know, and I got a great response from that. People were happier with me handing it to them and saying, this is what a possibility is, than me telling them, well, this is what it is. You know, like, I didn't have people come up to me and say, well, your character was too sexy, or your character, you know, I fell for what happened in the moment and it was just so shocking and scandalous. No, I had people that would read the Zero issue and they would come back to me and they were like, no, I have to read the rest. I need to know what happens. I need to know, you know, how this affects these people, because, you know, one of the things a lot of people will always connect with is tragedy, and that's just our human side, you know?
Right.
And I'm not writing you know, a love story. Well, it is, but it's a tragic love story. I mean, it's the story of a man who loses everything that he ever knew and realizes that he had nothing else to live for. So he's going to just do what he can, you know, to live through the next couple of days. And his life changes in every way because of that event. And I mean, you know, that happens to a lot of people. And that's what that event is. It's a life-changing event. And if it's used the right way, and if it's used as a plot element and not as a, you know, as a crutch or as something that doesn't show respect to those people that have been through that kind of thing, that's where you're going to have your problems.
True, true. Yeah, I mean, you have to, but that is very true that, you know, tragedy is a big part of the human experience. And it's easy to connect to people through that. You know, that's why there's so many dramas on TV. you know, if that wasn't true, then everything would be reality. Oh, wait, never mind.
Well, I mean, I hate to burst other people's bubble with this statement, but I've done it in comic book stores for years. Comic books are a soap opera.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's, you know, we can deny it as much as we want, but it's our monthly soap opera. We go every month to read what happened from the very last dun-dun-dun moment from the last month. And, you know, millions of women and millions of men and millions of people did it for, you know, as long as television lasted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to do it until television goes away and even further beyond that. I mean, you know, think of the Globe getting sold out and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The very first caveman with a bongo, you know, he was telling stories that, you know, I'm sure he didn't tell stories that were happy. And he told stories about Thronk getting eaten by the friggin', you know, mantis, you know, like whatever was there. And, you know, that's just how stories are. I mean, you've got to find a way to connect with your reader. You got to find a way to connect with the material as a creator. And it's those connections that make it great, you know. And some people aren't going to like it. Some people will. But that's opinions. Everybody's got one. So you got to expect those kind of things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's funny because a lot of readers don't see it. But, I mean, you look at when all of these things have been translated to other media, they've been big dramas, you know. Like, going back to what we were talking about, The Incredible Hulk. That TV show was a drama. One of my favorite shows, my wife made fun of me for years for watching it, was Smallville.
I so loved Smallville.
But that was a soap opera. To this day. Yeah, but exactly. But it was just like, it was a weekly soap opera. With
It was as cornball soap opera as you could get. But when he ran and did something super, you were like, yeah, that's Superman. And that's, you know.
Right, right.
Go to it.
Right, and he did that in between him and Lana having a love story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the car, you know. I always wondered what the insurance rate must have been for the Kent's trucks. Like, that guy blew up a truck every episode. You know, like, these people, they was just, no wonder they lived on a small farm. They couldn't live anywhere else. Their insurance rates were too high to go and live anywhere else.
Well, that's another thing I always wondered about the show, because I actually have farmers in my family, and you know, and it's even true in the comic book. Like, they have this big farm, but it's just Clark and Jonathan running the farm, you know. And then, you know, eventually, well, I mean, in the movies and the TV show, his father dies. But, like, in the comic books, Jonathan's still alive, and he's running the farm by himself as an old man. How? That's not possible.
You know? His son also was able to, in a blink of an eye, you know, spin the world backwards. So I'm sure, like, in a nanosecond, he would wake up, take a pee, and do all the chores and the farm, be ready for the day, you know, like.
I don't know. My uncle has dozens and dozens of hands that work on his farm. You know, it's like.
But not one of them Superman.
If well, that's
Superman,
true.
Superman, it would take less than a second.
Somehow I don't think the cows would appreciate being milked in less than a second.
Well, that's why you never saw Clark milk cows. That was always for John. See, there were things that he couldn't do that, you know, small tasks that Jonathan had to do.
Perfect. Oh, yes. So you were a Smallville fan. What do you think of Arrow?
I joined Arrow late in reruns, and I'm really impressed with it.
Okay.
I am one of those people that always looked at the Green Arrow as exactly what he was, you know, Batman light. And I just never, I never got it growing up. I never understood why people would read Green Arrow over Batman. You know, he had every copy you could have, to the Arrow Cave, to the Arrow Mobile, to, you know, the sidekick wearing red. Like, it was just, it just, to me, was it never connected. I never got it. And then, you know, Oliver's portrayal in Smallville was something modernized, and I enjoyed that character. And once he became, something I could picture away from Batman, I began to appreciate him more.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Justice League and all the other cartoons and stuff started to pull him in. And you would see that, the reaction of a lot of the DC characters, where they would call Ollie out and be like, you never had an original idea in your life, did you? And like, things like that. And once I saw that people, even in the DC universe, felt the same way I did, then I think I began to accept it more. And then seeing the spectacular fight scenes and the crazy acrobatics of Arrow, I was drawn in. And while I think it's a totally different monster from Smallville, and I hope that it doesn't try to become a new Smallville, which more than likely it's gonna, with all the guest appearances and things you hear about in the internet and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that's going to be a bad direction to take that show, because that show worked because he wasn't the Green Arrow. He was Arrow. He was a vigilante. And he didn't need to have that DC moniker to be interesting. And I hope that they're able to keep that up with him taking on that kind of role.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing that Warner Brothers and DC is doing. I like the show, but I'm with you too in the, I get the feeling sometimes when I'm watching it, like they wanted to do a Batman show, but decided not to because of the movie. So did Arrow instead. And, you know, there's a lot of Batman light aspects to it.
To me, I want to agree with you, but I don't think it was Batman. I honestly always thought it was Dick Grayson. I always felt like this show was supposed to be Nightwing. We were supposed to come in and get, you know, a tale of what happens when you've already been trained for the worst, you know? And that's really a lot of what happens in that show. It's a lot about how he becomes so buff and crazy to do all the psycho stuff that he does in preparations for the bad things that come down in the show. You know, like you get all the flashbacks of him training and things like that. And I honestly think that you couldn't do that with Dick Grayson, because you can't have those moments of Bruce Wayne training him because of the rights.
Right.
And that's why we got Arrow instead of Nightwing. But I think it's pretty much the same entity to me. I mean, Bloodhaven's even in the show, and you know, things like that. You know, there's a lot of connections to Nightwing, almost more so than I think to, you know, Oliver Queen himself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's true. I mean, in the Huntress.
Yeah.
And all those aspects, you know. I the one thing I think the show might be a good opportunity for, I've read a couple articles online, and I think it's a decent idea. I don't know if they'll do it or not. And the same thing with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., use it as a jumping on point to introduce a character that you're going to use in the movie universe, but you don't have to then tell their origin story in a movie. You know, like Flash is, that's one of the rumors, is that Barry Allen is going to be in this season of Arrow. And, which is interesting because they've said there's no superpowers in Arrow yet. How can they have the Flash without having superpowers? That's a whole other question.
I think personally that this is a ploy from Warner Brothers right now for us to get ready to seeing the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're going to have to accept, no matter what comes out with the Batman Superman movie, you know, right, it's either going to be awesome or it's going to be terrible, and people are going to complain about it till hell freezes over. No matter what happens with it, nobody's going to be happy, but everybody's going to see it and everybody's going to love it.
Right.
But because of the scope of how they portrayed Superman in Man of Steel, this was a guy who threw a punch and leveled a city block. It wasn't just him hitting a guy. It was the shock of his blast leveling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to introduce Batman. You finally introduced Superman in a power level that people can see visually in the comics. And right, you did it in a fantastic way. But now you're going to introduce Batman. We're going back to the concept where a guy with a boomerang, a car, a bunch of tights, and string can have a fight with the most powerful being in the world. Maybe the most powerful being ever.
Mm-hmm.
See, if they, I understand that's good reading, it makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, if they did it right and they did it true to character, the first meeting would be the last because Batman would have planned every contingency and would take him out in the first 3 seconds anyway. That's the whole point of the Batman character is that he's smart, he's a planner, and when you meet him, he already knows how to kill you in so many different ways, you might as well give up now.
Yeah, but you know, I agree with you in what you're saying, but I mean, did you see the Justice League animated movie Doom? Where very similar concepts about what we're talking about happen. You know, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. But if you haven't seen it, see it. It's awesome. But because I could believe in that scenario because he had years to plan. He knew the man. He knew his weaknesses. He knew where to strike. Yes, even if you establish Bruce Wayne as like this counter-terrorist guy who knows every secret about Bruce Wayne, you know, about Clark Kent, which apparently wasn't that hard to deduce because, you know, we finally had a star reporter figure it out, which was cool because it made sense that finally somebody who worked in media went, oh, I'm just going to trace the photos back to the source. So that made sense, but now it's still never going to level out with the fact that you have this character who is so epically powerful that the things that he did are beyond the scope of any mortal force. And that's where I think that movie's going to have problems. It's going to try to either dumb down Superman, and which is a shame because they finally made Superman the Superman we know him from the comics, or they're going to make Batman so ridiculously outlandish that you're not going to be able to connect with that Batman because he's so fantastic that he's not Batman. You know, he's the only way for that story to work is to make him some kind of super Marvel weapon. You know, like he's going to have his own Iron Man suit if they're ever going to have a scene where they fight together.
Yeah.
It's just too big of a range. It's just they made him so powerful in Man of Steel, it's going to be really hard to connect it.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, the action was so over the top in Man of Steel, it's really hard to think any mortal could go up against him. But, you know, the man we have was the Bomb and Phantoms, so he should be able to do it.
I'm not worried about Ben Affleck doing it. I'm actually more worried about the script itself.
Yeah.
I think that Ben Affleck will bring enough to it because, quite frankly, in the years that, you know, there's a big time gap between Daredevil and today. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Daredevil failed because Marvel movies at that time all failed. It wasn't just Daredevil, you know, Ghost Rider, Punisher, Man-Thing. I mean, you could name a list of movies that came out in that early 2000 time period that all were trying to make up off of Fox's huge demand of you know, X-Men that were all terrible. Spider-Man was excellent. X-Men was excellent. You name any other Marvel franchise from that time period, and it was terrible.
Elektra. Oh, no, wait. That doesn't help. Okay.
Yeah, no. And actually, in my opinion, I thought Elektra was one of the better out of the ones that I've mentioned. You know, I thought that she was at least close enough to the character to fill in that gap. But, you know.
Actually,
yeah, it's funny. That one was panned even worse than Daredevil, though.
Yeah, but that's because you picked a character nobody knew. It goes back to those dark characters that nobody are familiar with. Like, if you went to the general populace and you talked to 100 people and you said, who's Elektra in the Marvel Universe? You have no idea. You know, you'll get maybe one or two that'll be like, yo, she's the hot chick in red. Or you'll get maybe the hardcore geeks that they happen upon that'll be like, well, she's the best assassin who can, you know. But they're not going to be that many people that are going to be able to figure that out. And you got to establish that. Now you're establishing it off a movie that wasn't that great to begin with. Now you're doing it in a small little venue, and it's already a budget-cut film, and, you know. So it had things going against it, but that didn't take away from the fact that they did a lot of core elements to Elektra that they didn't hit in a lot of other characters. I mean, Ghost Rider is a perfect example of that. I mean, you really never at one point at any moment of the movie felt the real struggle that Johnny Blaze goes through on a day-to-day, because he was always so quickly moving to the next monster he had to fight, you know?
Mm.
So, you know, as much as Daredevil hurt, as much as Elektra hurt, as much as Ghost Rider hurt, I don't blame the characters in those films. I blame those films, because overall they failed. It was the writing that failed. It was the direction that failed. It was the moment, you know, it was a lot of that 90s action die down. You know, we were still dealing with the Arnold Schwarzenegger Tailspin era, you know, like, so you still had that kind of action movie in effect. And that's why it had to change. And that's why the Avengers was such a big changer. That's why Iron Man was such a game changer, you know?
Yeah.
Once you stopped focusing on the super and you just focused on the man, that's when the story became good, because that's what we have been focusing on for 700 issues, you know?
Right, right. And it's also, again, I've said this before on the podcast, but it's just the brilliance of casting Robert Downey Jr., because you casted somebody who had a lot of the same issues in his real life that Tony Stark had. So he could bring that character to life so easily. And he had a great script behind him as well.
And he's a great actor.
Yes.
He really is.
I also agree with that same kind of concept behind Spider-Man. You know, the very first Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, like, Tobey Maguire was kind of guy that you would see in the street and you would just kind of pass by him.
Mm-hmm.
You would think he was just an average kid. You would think that he just had average problems.
Right.
You would never assume that he was one of the most powerful beings in the world. And then having that movie created by a horror director made it even that much better, because Spider-Man's life is a horror.
Yes. You know?
There is no character in any universe who gets beaten down more, who deals with the more craziest villains. And I have never been a Spider-Man person. I just don't. It's not Spider-Man that bothers me. I just don't like his villains. I just never got behind him. To me, they're all very one-dimensional. It's usually somebody who wants revenge on Spider-Man for some reason, and they got turned into a monster, and that's part of it.
Right.
And I just never, you know, that kind of repetitive nature just never allured me to that character. But when I saw the Spider-Man movie, seeing him in that motion and seeing him in the places that I was familiar with, that's where it was sparked. And that's why the newer generation of movies is so much better. It's because, you know, they're not selling the property, they're selling the concept. And that's just a much better way to play it.
Right.
At least in my opinion.
Yeah. No, and it's funny too, real quick, Stan Lee was just on the Nerdist, and he actually happened to mention the Daredevil movie. And he said that, yeah, he thought that Affleck did a great job in that movie. And what the main thing that it suffered from was the story. They made Daredevil too much of a tragic character. They tried to make him too much of a tragic character in that movie. Like, there was no lightheartedness at all, you know? And he said that was, you know, that's what it suffered from, you know, like Daredevil always, there was always, when he created the character, there was always a little thing behind him where, you know, he was getting something over on someone, on everyone, because he was actually blind, but yet he had all these extra senses and could do all this stuff, but people didn't realize, like, you know, no one thought he was blind because he's doing all this great acrobatic stuff and whatnot. So, but there, like, that wasn't portrayed in the movie because it wasn't portrayed in the script anywhere. You know, so yeah, even Stan Lee likes Ben Affleck as Daredevil, so I guess we have to support him as Batman.
Hmm.
So what's the, I guess the question, my question for you now is, what are you working on, currently working on, and where can people go and find all your stuff?
Well, we're available at the Hound Comics website. We're through their store. You can get a print on demand that way. Issue one, like I said, should be out by, I would assume, you know, the next 2 weeks. It's just a matter of some different things that have to be done to it real fast to get it through.
Mm-hmm.
But issue two is midway through. It should be finished by the beginning of December. We'll have that posted up there. And that's all the Chronicles of Mayree line. The Zero issue is already available on the website. You know, we've done a lot of cons. We try to do as many as possible, and you could see, you know, our contact list that way. And Comixology, we're waiting for them to approve the comics that are in line for most of Hound's titles. And once they do that, and they can, you know, you'll be able to get it downloaded that way. And those are primarily the top ways you can get it. And as for what I'm working on, you know, I'm focusing on issue 2 and 3 for Mary. Those are, you know, my top priorities right now. And I'm hoping by the end of the year we will have at least Conquistador issue 1 out. And that story will run as a 5-issue title. And we'll do that whole miniseries as quick as possible. And we'll jump into the next one and see where that is. And hopefully, with all things aligned and everything running, we'll have Mary going as close to monthly as possible next year. And that's kind of the main goal right now.
Yeah. Do you find it, I mean, being an independent, you have a day job as well, I assume.
Yes.
So you find it harder to, you know, you're not writing and all the time, and I guess your artists probably have day jobs as well. So is that makes it harder to, you know, give yourself a deadline to say, you know, every month we're going to have an issue out. It's one of the things I find, again, independents suffer from. Do you find that it, or do you fear that that's going to hurt you in any way?
I know it's going to hurt me in the long run.
Yeah.
You know, it's just how we are as collectors. You know, we don't want to wait.
Yeah.
But I hope I'm telling a story that's so compelling that people will always wonder what's the next stage of where these characters are going. Like, you know, you're introduced to my character as someone who's very angry and very straightforward looking for revenge, but he wasn't that way 24 hours ago. You know, 24 hours ago, he was loved by his neighbors and he was looked at as, you know, as a very unique individual amongst his people. And I tell that story that way. And I hope that, you know, the uniqueness of Wolfgang and the interactions with Mitch and the craziness of Rahane and, you know, the people that are involved in that nightmare of a world, you know, are enough where people come back. And I will write the best story I can for everybody out there. I will make the story that I want to make, and I will hold nothing back. And I just want to make sure that people get the true telling of the story that I want, you know? And, yeah, it's a problem where you have that month-to-month issue. But I think people will have to understand that it's their support. You know, you go to the website and you keep looking and finding out what's going on. You know, that brings us advertisers. Advertisers bring us more scope. And, you know, word of mouth is huge. You know, Coat of Arms has its own Facebook page. You know, when you go to a Facebook page for Coat of Arms, you go to a Facebook page for Hound Comics, don't just like what you see. Share it. If you're willing to share a picture of a friggin' tuna fish sandwich that you're going to eat at lunch, share the awesome artwork that we're providing people. Share the stories. Because these are the things that will draw in not only the fans, they will make new fans, and they will make the community that everybody wants it to be. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, there's nothing better than when you walk into a comic book store and you've got all your like-minded friends and you are fighting about which Ninja Turtle was the best Ninja Turtle that month on, you know, in the comic. You know,
Donatello. But never mind.
I'm a Donatello fan myself, always. You know, you always want to talk about those kind of things. You always want to have that kind of hardcore love for it. And I know as the creator, I have that love going into it. I know that my artist has that love going into it. I know that my, you know, my team around me, the people at Hound, we're that passionate. And that's why we're creating what we are week in and week out. You know, every day we try to move forward to provide you with what, you know, what we think you guys want. You know, we're not trying to change our stories, but we're trying to get on the easiest format for you to find it. We're trying to get in everybody's face. We're trying to be at the biggest shows. We're trying to be the name that people talk about because it's worth it. You know, like, the stories are great.
Right.
The characters that we have been doing and the things that we're building, I think, they're the future, you know? A long time ago, Image started as a place where a band of misfits got tired of getting screwed over and decided, you know what, we're the best of the best, and we're going to do what we can. I can't lay the claim that I came from the X-Men. I can't lay the claim that I came from, Batman. But I can tell you I read hundreds of those stories. I can tell you that I've spent years developing what I've created. I can tell you that, if I can, I'll write this story till the day I die, and I'll love every issue. And when characters are killed off and when things don't go the way people expect, I'll mourn those characters with people,
Go back to a character you're killing off. You want to, spoilers?
I will tell you this. As the world grows, you will feel the same pains that the characters feel with the work. We start off with Wolfgang being very broken and very alone, but being so driven that he draws people to him like a magnet. And it's those people that will redefine who he becomes. And it's those lives will be the ones that you want to care more about than my main character. I honestly believe that Wolfgang will be the anti-hero that everybody loves and hates, but my characters around him will be the characters that they love to talk about. Flora, Mitch, these are characters that aren't in any of the comics yet. Zarkon, if you went to the webpage, Coat of Arms Comics, you could see there's a preview page of all the characters. Raven, Zarkon, Fireforge, Mitch, all of them. My story is ready for them, and as they develop into it, and as you learn more about how Wolfgang gets the gifts that he has and the characters around him and the universe that they're in, you will only learn to feel for their plight. You will only learn to love them more, and that's the fun of it,
So
if I could, I would print the treatment so everybody could read it, but I don't think anybody would find it as enjoyable as I do, but it's over 45 pages long,
Yeah.
50 issues plotted. I've got 7 issues written. I've got 3 more waiting to be edited. I'm as passionate about it as anybody in the industry. And, I want people to enjoy it. And even if it's only 5 or 10, which I don't want just 5 or 10 people to enjoy it, I'd be happy with that, but I wouldn't be satisfied. I think that it's we at Hound are all creating stories that have such amazing scope and are so good that you just have to dive into it,
So I need to ask you real quick, because you've mentioned a lot of elements that remind me of one of my favorite authors, and I need to know if you're a fan of his. Do you read Jim Butcher?
I do not.
Oh my goodness. I think John can attest to this. He's saying so many elements that just remind me of the Dresden Files.
Yeah, it sounds like how long have you had this storyline in your head? Because it sounds like you've been working on this a very long time.
I will be honest with you. When I was about 17, I met a friend of mine who his name is Jim Quitadongo, and Jim was or is a part of a company called Dominion, and he and I connected, and I've been plotting out Mary since I was 17 years old, and part of the reason I love the story so much is I just got tired of plotting it out, and I had to write it, otherwise I probably would have had an aneurysm, and that's what it's been. It's a lot of... It's kind of like an output of personal issues and beliefs. Like, I'll give you guys a little bit of what I'm talking about. In the very first Zero issue, I use the mythology where my characters are in a world where there's a high goddess. And the high goddess lived in a time before time where she was the only being who lived with what was known as the singularity. And in the story, as they exist alone, you know, the singularity, which will become all things, explains the universe to her and explains people and, you know, all the things that you see in the day to day. And because she had never experienced anything other than the singularity, she couldn't grasp that scope. So the singularity caused what is called, you know, an explosion, which is not, or if not, the Big Bang. And in that time when, you know, the universe is cooling and she's alone, she creates the other gods. And, you know, to me, that's my way of saying, why can't God have created a Big Bang? Why does religion have to point out how things were in one specific manner? Why couldn't all these things be true? And, you know, I look at religions and I see people fighting over the same core beliefs just told by different people. And that doesn't make sense to me. And there are those kind of ideals in my story, you know, like my characters are very oppressed by, you know, an all powerful government that can do whatever it wants because there's nobody to stand up to it until there's finally somebody who stands up and says, this isn't how it's supposed to be. You know, we are the people and we are the mass and we are the ones with the voice. You're supposed to be the one that helps protect us. You're the one that we are supposed to turn to in our hour of need. It's not supposed to be the other way around. And, you know, there are a lot of those kind of elements and those kind of beliefs that I have in the story. I mean, I don't write a black or white tale. You know, it's a lot of gray. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of moral characters that people are going to understand and not understand. Like, one of the future characters that is probably going to premiere around issue 10 or 11, depending on if I edit out some pages or not, is Flora. And Flora is a princess of the elven race. And she is a dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore elven racist. And she will use slang that will be the worst slang that, you know, humanity could be called. But that's because she was a princess brought up to be a racist in a world full of racists. You know what I'm saying? It's not because of her having any other way of being taught. You know, that,
right.
that racism was brought down upon her by her ancestors. And that will cause a ton of conflict in the story, you know, because, you know, my main character is not going to want to be looked at as anything less. And, you know, one of the driving issues that will come up later is the term only human. And, you know, Wolfgang will never adhere to that concept. He doesn't believe in an only human concept. You know, we're all flawed. And in my world where there's other races, they're flawed as well. And he's going to point that out to people that are going to hate that. And, you know, it's a human telling of a story in a very fantastical way. And I hope that everybody jumps on board because I've been on board pretty much my whole life. And now I'm bringing it to everybody else. And I really think that once it's in its running stage and it's going quickly and people can get to it as fast as possible, it's going to be the kind of thing people are going to freak out page by page, week by week, you know, and month by month, they're going to wait for the next one. And I've gotten so much positive feedback from everybody who's read it. And, you know, everybody who's seen the first, you know, when I was at Comic-Con, anybody I sold the Zero issue to came back the next day to buy the first issue. And they're like, when is the second one coming out? And, you know, my answer to them was, we'll buy another issue and we'll figure it out. You know, like that's kind of how it ran, you know?
Right.
And I don't know if that's the response a lot of people get on their own. I don't, you know, I can only adhere to what I did and know what I put together. But I've always gotten a great response. I got a great response in Chicago. I got a great response in New York. You know, if I end up in California one day, I hope I get a great response there. And, you know, wherever I go, I'm going to bring the story to people and I'm going to bring every story I create and I'm going to express the same kind of passions that I put into it as, you know, as I do put into it, because I love what I'm doing right now. It's, you know, I hate to say that it's a hobby. It's more than a hobby for me. And a lot of people think that it's a hobby for me, but you know, one day when I'm sitting in some huge Hound office, you know, helping create the next big thing from Hound, you know, I look back at these moments and go, you know, this is how it happened, you know, these kind of conversations and just getting it out to the people.
No, I mean, you can definitely, you can definitely hear you're passionate about it, and you know, you always have to follow your passions, because like you said, if you don't, you're gonna end up with an aneurysm. So it's, and everything that you've said, it sounds great. I mean, you have a, it sounds like you have a great plan, a well thought out story, a lot of great elements you can bring in. So I will definitely be checking out the book, and I think all of our listeners after this should run out to Hell and Comics and order your copy today, or you know, at the next con, try to pick up an issue. So and like Joe said, everyone go to their Facebook page, Coat of Arms, and like them, and go to Hell and Comics and like them as well, cause,
and share everything they post.
And share everything they post, because just because, you know, you like them doesn't mean other people are just going to find them. You know, you got to spread the word.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, I think on that note, everyone, we're going to wrap it up for this week. So thanks, Joe, for being on.
Hey, no problem. It was a pleasure. You guys ever want to do this again, you let me know.
All right. Yeah. And as always, for everyone out there, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Hey everyone, you just listened to an episode of Superhero Speak. This is Dave. You can reach me at dave@superheroespeak.com. Also, if you're listening to this through the website, did you know you can go to iTunes and subscribe to it? So check us out there.
And this is Ben from Superhero Speak, which you can reach at ben@superheroespeak.com. And did you know you could also follow us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/superheroespeak.
This is John. You can reach me at john@superheroespeak.com, and if you want, there's our Twitter account @superheroespeak.
All right. Thanks, and check us out at those spots.